Welcome to How Did You Think of That? My name is Temple Grandin, Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. How do we create a society and education system that is more inclusive for all kinds of minds and abilities? Temple and guest Matthew Wappett offer a lot of ideas and solutions. Matthew Wappett is Executive Director of the Utah State University Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice. On this episode, he joins us to discuss the Institute's accomplishments and ongoing efforts to make the education system more inclusive to all individuals.
So the Institute for Disability Research at Utah State is what is referred to as a UCED, a UCEDD, a University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. And we're actually one of the older centers. We were started in 1972, so we actually just had our 50th anniversary last year. But my background is in disability. I have my degrees from the University of Utah, not Utah State University, but I've taught special education. I work in Medicaid and adult services, and I do a lot around inclusion and mental health right now. And how do we create inclusive environments for people with disabilities? And then how do we support the mental health of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities? So that's kind of a brief overview.
In addition to education and services, the Institute conducts research and provides between 40 and 60 research studies every year. The Institute also annually serves approximately 15,000 people with disabilities in Utah, which includes a lot of early intervention with young children and children with autism spectrum disorders.
All different kinds of disabilities.
All different kinds, yeah. Although we do quite a bit, of course, Utah has one of the highest prevalence rates of autism, and so we do a lot with autism spectrum disorders here. And then our technical assistance division does a lot of work on disability policy and helping states and the federal government come up with policies that are more supportive for people with disabilities in our communities and schools.
Do you know why there would be a higher rate? Are there any hypotheses as to why Utah has a higher rate of autism?
There's hypotheses. There's no convincing evidence. I will tell you that my sense is that we have some really solid resources here. We have the University of Utah Medical School, we have the Home Clinic, we have the Institute for Disability where I work. There's a lot of supports and diagnostic centers here in Utah, so it's getting accurate autism diagnoses is more accessible here in the state. So that's kind of when you look at the overall epidemiology, I think a big part of it is probably just due to we have some resources that maybe other states are lacking. So we have more people diagnosed.
I would agree with that. I get asked this question all the time, and especially when there's no speech delay. I think most of those in the past just weren't diagnosed, because I have lots of grandparents come up to me, and they discover they're autistic when the kids or the grandkids get diagnosed.
Yep, you're exactly right. And there's a lot of people in the past who would have been diagnosed with autism, but with people weren't aware of it. And so a lot of people kind of flew under the radar, especially if they didn't have a speech delay.
Well, that's right. You know, this would be the ones that's autism with no speech delay.
Yep.
And how did you get into this work? What inspired you?
So I grew up being very aware of the students with disabilities in my high school. Of course, back in the 70s and 80s, they were segregated. And I always wondered why these students with disabilities were segregated and weren't in my classes. And it was something that just weighed on me. But then I actually went and worked overseas for a few years. I worked in Taiwan and China, where I did some human rights work with people with disabilities. And Taiwan and China had a very strong institutional system where people with disabilities were locked up and were kind of isolated and hidden away. And that really made me aware of, you know, my experience in school, but then my experience in Taiwan and China, seeing the way that people with disabilities were treated, made me very aware that we, as a society, whether it's America, China, anywhere, that we're just not doing a great job integrating this aspect of diversity into our community. So I came back and
talking about all disabilities, blindness, deafness.
Yep. I'm talking about everything. The ones that I primarily work with are on the more serious, severe end, so intellectual and developmental disabilities. But yeah, I mean, students with learning disabilities, students with high functioning autism struggle to find a place within our communities and within our schools. And so I think, yeah, as a society, we just don't do a very good job. The thing that pushed me over the edge was I was an English teacher, and I taught English at a school in Salt Lake City, and 60% of the kids in my class had a disability. And I realized I hadn't been taught how to work with these students. And so I went back to school and got a master's and a PhD, focused on disability issues and inclusion. And the majority of my career has been spent working with educators and communities on how do we create more inclusive programs, schools, community events, whatever it is, that integrate people with disabilities, but also all aspects of diversity. When you talk about inclusion, it doesn't have to be just disability. I mean, we're struggling with including people from all sorts of diverse backgrounds in our country right now. And those principles of inclusion cut across all sorts of different demographic categories. So that's a Cliff Notes version, Sherry, of how I got into it.
And when you said 60% had disabilities, what kind of disabilities would you say?
Oh, in my class when I was teaching? Mm-hmm. Oh, it was everything from autism to learning disabilities to mental health issues. I mean, so when I say 60% of my class had what's called an IEP, an individualized education program, which is what students in special education get. And so that's, again, there's a wide variety of disabilities that would qualify for that. So anything from attention deficit disorder to dyslexia to schizophrenia to cerebral palsy, autism. Anyway, so when I say that, it was students who were on those IEP plans. They were specifically designated as special ed students.
Well, the thing that always bothers me is as I go back and forth from the world of autism and disabilities and the world of construction and building things, I've worked with people that were either autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD that owned metal fabrication shops, prosperous businesses with lots of patents. And they were not disabled when it came to designing things like feed mills and equipment and meat plants and things like this, you know, mechanical equipment. And, you know, without some of the people, these skills, I mean, they're not going to keep the water systems running. I'll tell you that right now. Special ed keeps that stuff going.
Yep, I totally agree.
This is the problem. And this is why when I talk about disabilities, you'd be more sick. I have problems with lumping it all together, where you're blind and deaf, and maybe an amputated leg, and this is all put together because they require really different kinds of accommodations.
Yep.
I was just talking about accommodations at work this morning on an autism group, and some very simple accommodations, like using pilot checklists to write down the sequence of a task, like closing out a cash register, for example, would prevent a lot of jobs from being lost. The tasks they have to do that day, write them down on a checklist. I need an external working memory. That's an extremely simple accommodation, which for people on the autism spectrum would save a ton of jobs.
I totally agree. I mean, I think when you think about it, disability is very much dependent upon context. And so, you know, kind of when you were talking about people who are disadvantaged in one setting but aren't in another, I think dyslexia is a great example. Dyslexia didn't even exist until the 1960s, when all of a sudden we expected everyone to learn how to read. Prior to that, you could go become a mechanic or, you know, become something without having to read. But as society has become more and more text literate, dyslexia has become more of a thing. But, you know, I totally agree. Context makes a huge difference, and we're not very good at creating contexts that are flexible and that allow people
I'm totally visual. So when mm-hmm. I'm seeing a person working on the mechanical equipment in the shop, or I'm now seeing where those Blade Runner feet, where an amputee who's beating regular runners, especially if they engineered the legs and they had to make rules on how those legs were designed.
Yep.
I actually gave an advantage on
yep.
where the Blade Runner foot was designed. You see, being a visual thinker, I think very specific. One thing I've learned about verbal thinking, and I discussed that in my book, Visual Thinking, is how much it overgeneralizes. Because I'm looking at it, I had a blind roommate when I was in graduate school. And she needed one simple accommodation when she got her new classes. She had to have a student leader guide through the campus for how you get to your new classes once, just once, each semester. Then she would remember the way by feeling the ground with her cane.
It's amazing. Yeah, it really is incredible just how much of a difference context and being flexible can be.
That's
I mean,
right. And I think that I like very specific things. And I was talking to the group this morning. I was saying, all right, here's simple accommodations. Pilot's checklist for jobs involving sequence or tasks you have to do that day. Avoiding the rapid multitasking jobs for some individual on the spectrum of LED lights that flick, getting rid of that. For some dyslexics, only a subgroup, sometimes printing up the assignments on the colored paper works, real pale pastel colored paper, or you change the backgrounds on the computer. Nobody knows really why that works, but there's a subgroup of dyslexia where that works.
Yep.
I like to let people know about these very simple things that they can try, don't cost anything. I've seen college careers save with colored paper.
Now,
80% of the dyslexics doesn't work. There's a subgroup where it does.
Yep. Yep.
And the pilot's checklist, over and over again, I hear about a job being lost. If they had just been able to write down, this was an electrician apprentice, write down the electrical things they had to install that day. Like, they were switched by the door, regular light switched by the bed, just something that simple. Because when it's yacked out to the person, you know, yak, in speech, I can't remember the sequence. I would have to, if I had that job, I would have to write down the things that I'd have to install and where to install. Just jot it down. Take 2 minutes. That's all.
And that's, I think, one of the hard things that we see when we look at employment of people with disabilities is here in the U.S., we're very much about standardizing things and we're not flexible. Our schools are not flexible. Our workplaces are not flexible.
But the people I worked with, they're all retiring now, they're not getting replaced.
Right.
And there's stuff we don't make in the U.S., like the state-of-the-art electronic chip-making machine. It's from Holland. And one of the reasons for that is they, on a skilled trades, they don't stick their nose up at it. And I'm talking high-end skilled trades. I'm not talking about roofing floor tiles, things that are just hard work. I'm talking about real high-end skilled trades.
Yeah, we've definitely moved away from that in this country, for sure. We've completely dismantled our vocational training system, and we expect everyone to go to college, and that's not always the most effective route, especially for people with disabilities.
Well, the other problem I'm running into now, where some of the schools are putting shop classes back in, I've run in now two different states where they won't let special ed kids take shop. I talked to a student just a couple of days ago, and he told me that he had to really, really work hard to convince the school system that he could take shop. And then I go back to the projects I worked on 25 years ago out on big, heavy construction projects where the special ed kid owned the shops. You see, this is what makes me want to pull my hair out as I go back and forth between these worlds. Of course, they were not diagnosed, but I've worked with individuals who are very autistic, very socially awkward. I can remember really where I had to drag a guy out of a shop at a plant because he was bad-mouthing a plant engineer where he could hear him. And I had to drag him out of there before he got fired.
No, it's...
And he was brilliant at what he did. He had 20 patents, stuff that's used all around the world.
It's incredible. It's incredible. Just the stories that are out there and just how much culture and society has changed. I mean, I do think it's interesting to look at some other countries where people with autism spectrum disorders are really succeeding. If we look at Scandinavia, and we look at Denmark and Holland and other places where they have specific programs that they've designed to hire people with autism spectrum disorders, or because they see the benefits of hiring them because they have very specific way of seeing the world.
I went to the pharmacy in the U.S. that's they have test software, test websites, and they set some company hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars because they found a phone number that was wrong on one of the websites.
Yep.
Well, a lot of lost business.
And it just takes being creative. I say that the disability employment, people at my work get tired of this, but I always tell them that the employment crisis for people with disabilities in the U.S. is a crisis of creativity. And our workplaces are not creative enough to figure out ways to individualize these jobs and to leverage the skills and the talents of these people. And as a result, you know, for people with disabilities, what, we're at a 40% unemployment rate for all disabilities, and for intellectual and developmental disabilities, a 70 to 75% unemployment rate, which would be unacceptable for any other group. Yeah. But a lot of it is just a lack of creativity on the part of how we've structured our workplaces and our schools and everything else.
I tend to look at things much more specifically. And I think I told you about some interventions that would work in dyslexia, autism, and sensory processing problems. Another thing that can help with some of the sensory oversensitivity is several families have told me now that when they let their kid play with a vacuum cleaner that made a horrible noise, where they turned it on, play with a leaf blower, where the kid turned it on, it got to where they could tolerate it, when they controlled it. See, I'm always looking for little simple interventions like this. Another boy in his 20s, I talked to last week, was able to ditch his headphones because he played audio recordings of noises where he worked at gradually increasing volumes, so he controlled it. Now, he still has to do some sensory breaks, still has to do that, but he said he ditched his headphones. See, but the problem is the people that wear them all the time, they just get more and more sensitive. You see, and then I'm thinking about, okay, for someone in a wheelchair, you have to have ramps. That's a totally different accommodation than maybe a pilot's checklist for somebody that has terrible auditory working memory. You see, I see it as, see, when you think visually about it, they're so different.
They are very different, and yet to a certain extent, I think the important thing is to individualize things. A lot of times we view...
Well, absolutely. And, of course, the law says, you know, the least restrictive environment, and that would not mean putting them away in, you know, some of the different place.
Yep. You know,
when I went to elementary school, we had a student that had a heart problem, had a hole in her heart, and she couldn't really do sports, but she was goalie in soccer, and we made all kinds of accommodations, and she got along just fine. This was back in the 50s. They didn't know how to correct it back then.
I think one of the big problems that we face here in the United States when we think about inclusion and when we think about including people with disabilities in our workplaces is that we're often focused on training the people with disabilities to fit in. And what that does is that requires a person, an individual, to change aspects about themselves to fit into a culture or a workplace or anything else. Unfortunately, with disability, a lot of these things can't be changed. A person with autism can't change the way their brain works. A person with dyslexia can't change the way that they read. A person who's missing their leg can't grow another leg. And so teaching somebody to fit in doesn't actually address the problem. Where the interventions need to be is with employers, is with schools, is with teachers, is with classrooms, so that we're teaching people who are part of the quote unquote in group, right, who have the power, who create these contexts, how to be more flexible, how to be more open, how to be more creative, and how they include different people.
I just look at it, I now make this list of simple accommodations, like the pilot's checklist for people on the autism spectrum. That pilot's checklist thing alone saved a ton of jobs, just a ton.
Yeah.
And if the boss objects, I say, pilots need a checklist, I need one too, and pilots have to.
But you're right. You're exactly right.
You can just say, I need a pilot's checklist. okay, let me just write down a checklist for closing out the cash register at Walmart. Or if it's something where I'm going to be doing different things each day and stocking shelves, well, I'm going to stock the cereal aisle and the cosmetic aisle. So let me write it down. It takes 30 seconds.
It's easy. It doesn't take a lot. It's relatively simple, and yet we still struggle with it.
Sometimes it takes questioning, because I talked to a lady who's going to get a PhD in vocational rehab, and an autistic guy lost a job at some retail store. I don't remember what kind of store it was, some kind of retail shop, and he couldn't stand the environment in that store, and the rehab people said, we'll just give you another autistic person. Well, that really annoyed the shopkeeper, because they said, well, that's just, I have to train them. You know what was wrong? They couldn't tolerate the sound of a single Christmas carol. Not kidding. That would have been so simple to fix. Turn it off. Change the playlist. Put the headphone on that place. Lost their job over that. But you see, there, it gets a bit more specific. You're going to have to ask more questions, and people don't do that. The other big problem I'm seeing is label lock. And Deborah Moore and I discussed that in the book Navigating Autism. And they don't think a kid could do anything. I'm appalled at the number of kids, teenagers that are, and young adults have now gone shopping by themselves. I ran into one of them yesterday at the airport. Maybe the best thing that ever happened to this family was that my plane had a serious mechanical issue and my flight was delayed for 3 hours. And I met them in the airport. And the 13-year-old real math whiz with autism had never gone in a store by himself. Never had. Fully verbal. You know what we did? We went over to where one of those stores were. And we stood like 25 feet away across the hall in an angle. You could see the front of the store. Sent him in there to buy something. And found out the store didn't pay cash. I didn't know that. But that was the first time he'd been in a store by himself. And then I said, well, he needs to do stuff like working skills, like learn how to do a task on a schedule outside the family. And how about walking dogs? And the mom says, well, he walks our dog. I said, oh, he used to walk Mrs. Jones's dog. Somebody else's dog. Where you're working for somebody outside the family. And I said, and they said, well, a therapist never suggested this. I said, the next time you're pumping gas, send him into the store to buy some milk or something.
That's incredible. They're lucky that they were able to interact with you that way and hopefully
learn
something.
Well, the second time I've done the shopping thing at the airport.
Really?
Yeah, I was a 12-year-old, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I did the same thing, and she went and bought a drink.
That's great. I'm sure that changed. Hopefully, changed his life for the better. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's important.
I'm kind of appalled by the don't think the kid can do anything.
Well, that's really, I think, one of the greatest struggles is just in this country, and we specifically struggle with this in Utah. A lot of parents have such low expectations of
this
their kids.
This came out in just Utah. This was Texas I was in.
Yeah.
I don't care what state it's in, I'm finding this problem.
Yeah. I mean, expectations are so low, and you're exactly right. There are students who are graduating from high school who have never gone shopping by themselves, who have never learned how to do the most basic right functions of daily life because they've been sheltered.
That's your problem.
It is a big problem. That was a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
Well, you see, that's what happens with me is my mind thinks of specific examples, but now the shopping thing. Oh, that's probably the 30th, 50th parent I've talked to about the shopping issue.
But it is, I mean, I think it illustrates exactly how easy some of this can be. It's not hard. It just takes questioning and asking, what can we do to make this job better? What can we do to include you? I mean, the colored paper. Turning off the Christmas carols. I mean, all of these things are the checklist, right? They're all very, very simple things that all of a sudden.
I ask them, do you ever see flicker on lights or the print jiggling on the page? I have taken a book, it's called Girl Loves Cows, and it has a whole bunch of pastel colored pages. I have taken that book at bookstores and shown it to people, and they said, I can see, I can read. And then the other day, I took a little ticket for a veterinary workshop that was light blue and showed it to a student, And she said, I can read that. I said, she wants to be a veterinary nurse. I said, now let's try some different colors, find the best one that works.
And it worked? I want
to make it very clear, that does not work for all dyslexia, only a subtype.
It also works for people with seizure disorders, we found. So we found that there are people with seizure disorders where color of paper makes a big difference.
Head injuries, too.
So, wearing yellow tinted glasses. So if paper, I worked with somebody a long time ago in Alaska who had a seizure disorder. And in order to read, she had to wear yellow glasses because nothing was printed on yellow paper. You know, if it was printed on yellow paper, she could read it, but she just wore yellow glasses and all of a sudden she could read everything.
I had a student that bought some kind of a lavender sunglasses and she said, I got an A on my economics exam because the PowerPoint slides on the screen no longer jiggle.
Yeah. When's the last time you read about colored paper in a textbook for teachers or in a workplace manual? Nobody talks about it.
A study on dyslexia and colored paper. You're going to find it doesn't work because 80% of the time it does not work.
Right. Yep.
It only works 10 to 20% of the time. But when it works on that subgroup, it works. And it's such a simple thing to try.
I think one of the important things as you talk about this is teaching not only the professionals that there are these tools out there, but also teaching the people with disabilities, with dyslexia, with autism, with other things, to be advocates for themselves, to say, this is what I need to be successful. And I think that is a really important skill that's being left out of education, is we're not teaching students with disabilities to advocate for themselves as well as we could.
You are listening to How'd You Think of That with Temple Grandin and guest Matthew Wappett, researcher, writer, and educator. Another issue Temple addresses is the broad autism spectrum and the now officially recognized term of profound autism. The Lancet Commission estimated that close to 50% of people on the autism spectrum are in this category.
I just had a reporter call me, and there's a lot of controversy going on about terms like profound autism. And you're going from Einstein to somebody who owns a metal fabrication shop or is a computer scientist out at Google to somebody who can't dress themselves. But then some of those nonverbals that don't speak, they can learn to type independently, totally independently. They've got a brain inside there. And then I'm looking at jobs that have been successful. You've got the verbal kind of autistic. And where jobs have been very successful is what I call client specialized retail. I've made a category. Selling cards. I have 4 or 5 cases of that. Selling office supplies has been successful. Sporting goods and car automobile parts. And at the automobile parts store, the autistic person memorized every part number in the warehouse. But you see, all of those retail establishments are relatively quiet.
Yep.
Another one that's been worked is ice cream because you can serve one customer at a time.
You're right. I mean, the checklist makes it more accessible, and not just for people with autism or dyslexia or whatever. A checklist actually makes it easier for everybody. I mean, I think that's the one thing, the one big fallacy that we find with disability in the workplace is there's the assumption that accommodations require people to bend over backwards and really do things that are very difficult. And honestly, the majority of accommodations are very simple, very easy, and not only benefit people with disabilities, but can benefit everybody.
I've talked to a lot of people that have been on SSI and payments like this. And then if they make, depends upon the state, but if they make too much money, they lose all the benefits. And one of the things I've talked to a lot of people with, in fact, my blind roommate was one of them, is she said, well, I could give up the paycheck if I could just keep the health insurance. In other words, take the paycheck away, but keep the health insurance. And I think this would help with a lot of employers. They get worried about big health bills on their company policy. That'd be another very simple thing that could be done. And that's something, but the thing they really can't go without is health insurance. And this is a problem for a lot of freelancers. But there's a lot of people with disabilities where they could give up the payments if they could just keep the health insurance. There's something we need to be doing on policy. I'll tell you right now, that's what needs to be done. Because I just got back from West Virginia. Well, I went to a very low-income area. I talked to a man who's a caseworker out in the field. 80% of the kids are living with grandparents because the parents are drug addicted. Many babies are born, you know, drugs in their system. And the kid gets a diagnosis, they want the kid's paycheck. It's a real mess. But then I've talked to other people, where if they could just have the health insurance, then they wouldn't have to worry about making too much money and losing their health insurance.
No, that's a huge one. And I think there's a fallacy among employers that people with disabilities are sick more, are a larger liability, and that's actually played out to not be true, right? But there's a lot of employers are reticent to put people with disabilities.
Well, I think we have to be looking at the type of disability. For a person that's blind, I would definitely say that is true. Yeah. Deaf and blind. They do not have other health problems. Because the number one cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. is health issues. Back in the 70s, I had to pay for surgery. And it was expensive, but it was nowhere near like it is now.
You'll go bankrupt now.
Well, you will go bankrupt. That's the problem. No, I actually went 10 years without health insurance in my 20s.
Yeah, it would be hard to do that these days.
This is something where you've got a system that's just disincentivizing getting jobs. The health insurance is the thing that's real easy to get if you have any kind of a disability. And that would help get a lot more employed.
It absolutely would.
I see too many parents locked into the label, like on the autism thing. Like, you know, this boy that, you know, gifted in math and had never been in a store by himself.
We end up teaching a lot of adults with disabilities those basic life skills because they come out of school and they don't learn them at home. They're not learning them at school. So we have programs actually at the Institute for Disability where we're teaching people those basic life skills.
Well, that's something that's really important to teach them.
Yep.
You know, but they're not getting that. Gigantic metal fabricating businesses. They started with a single welding class. I'm not saying welding's for everybody, but that's just, you know, a specific example. But the whole learning work skills. I mean, we need to be doing a gradual transition to work, but we're still in high school. So let's say the kid's in college. I'm seeing kids graduate from college and they lose it in the workplace. They need to be doing some jobs while they're in college. Hopefully career relevant, but learning work skills while they're in college. And there's a guy named Brad McGarry who was very, very good, worked at a college back in New York. And, he had a special program for kids on autism spectrum. One of the things they had to do was they learned life skills and it was part of the college program. Really, really basic stuff.
Well, there's a lot of kids who don't have disabilities who are going to college who don't know how to do budgets and money. We expect that somehow it goes back to the checklist thing. We somehow expect that people are somehow going to pick this up on their own. And really, a lot of these things need to be taught very explicitly. And we would all benefit from...
Well, that's right. You see, that was done in the 50s. Social skills were taught. You were taught to shake hands. You were taught to say please and thank you. Grown-ups corrected little kids all the time. If I stuck my hand in the mashed potatoes, my mother would say, use the fork. You were given the instructions. That was done in a much more structured way in the 50s. And that's one of the reasons why the grandparents have jobs. Now, where the diagnosis was helpful was with relationships. That's why I did this for different, not less. And on relationships, the diagnosis is helpful. But I'm saying on the autism, fully verbal, on the job front, I think it's holding them back. There's too much of getting locked into the label. So let's say you're on the policy front. I think the number one thing we need to be doing for people with disabilities is make sure they don't lose their health insurance if they work too many, make too much money. No matter what, keep the health insurance.
No, you're exactly right. A lot of people with disabilities, especially more severe disabilities, are on Medicaid, right? Because that's the primary health insurance. And as a result, they're unable to work because to qualify for Medicaid, they essentially have to be in poverty. And so, yeah, to maintain their health insurance, they can't work, which then means, right, they're impoverished, which then and then they're stuck, right? You're trapped.
Well, they're stuck. I had one man say to me, it's a trap.
It's a huge problem. And you know, the other problem too, related to that, and I don't know if you've heard of this, is the marriage penalty. So people with disabilities, like anybody else, like to get, right, like to have relationships and get married. And a lot of times when they get married, they lose their benefits and they lose their health insurance, they lose their social security. And that's been something that a lot of advocates are working to address as well.
I don't know, maybe I've given you some different ways to look at some of these things, but when it comes to policy, people with disabilities need to not have to worry about losing their health insurance. That would probably be the single most important policy thing you could do.
I totally agree. Health insurance has become more important than anything else in this country right now.
Okay, well, it's good to talk to you, and I'm going to leave the meeting.
It's good to talk to you, too. Thank you.
That was Temple Grandin speaking with Matthew Wappett, Executive Director of the Utah State University Institute for Disability Research, Policy, and Practice. How'd You Think of That is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center.